The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today's program is underwritten by the law firm of W.G. Alexander & Associates. Alexander attorneys provide top-rated and experienced legal counsel, concentrating on estate planning, elder law, special needs, and asset protection. Call W.G. Alexander & Associates at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the special year-end edition of The Week, titled The Faces of 2021. It's dated December 31st, 2021, January 7th, 2022. So it's a two-week issue, and then they take a week off. We'll get two readings, and then they'll have a week off, and the next issue is due out January 21st. As always, the cover drawing on the Faces issue is quite busy, a lot going on. I'll try to do it the best I can. The scene is a COVID vaccination station. Looks like it could be a gymnasium or auditorium. At the head table, President Joe Biden is doing the vaccines. Seated by him is getting a shot is Senator Joe Manchin. And he's ripping apart a Build Back Better bill, got a stern look on his face. Right behind him in line is Senator Kyrsten Sinema. She's got a stern look and her arms crossed. Behind them in line are Dr. Anthony Fauci and Governor Ron DeSantis in a little tussle. DeSantis is trying to pull the mask off an alarmed Dr. Fauci. Behind them is Mark Zuckerberg. He's got on some virtual reality kind of mask he's looking into. Behind him, President Vladimir Putin is whispering in the ear of Chinese Premier Xi Jinping. Behind them, Britney Spears is raising two arms in triumph with a sign that says, "Free Britney." And then you can barely see behind them, Supreme Court Justice Amy Coney Barrett is holding up a sign that says hashtag Team Life. And behind her, Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh. Over to the side behind Biden are President Trump, former President Trump, and one of the rioters, the infamous guy with the woolly headdress with the horns and the flag. And Trump's actually dressed just like him. They're giving each other a high five, and on Trump's belly is painted the words, "Stop the Steal." Behind them, Representative Liz Cheney is looking on like, what's going on? And over her shoulder, Simone Biles is doing kind of a backflip on one of the desks. And that captures a lot, the faces of 2021. This week we'll catch up on the current news, and then in the next show we'll go with more of the year in review specials. So starting with the main stories, Biden seeks to salvage Build Back Better. What happened? President Biden and Democrats restarted negotiations with Senator Joe Manchin on a modified Build Back Better bill this week after the West Virginia centrist Democrat angered progressives and the White House by declaring he wouldn't support the legislation in its current form. Manchin's announcement, "This is a no," was made during a Fox News appearance and followed weeks of negotiations with the White House aimed at securing Manchin's buy-in on the $1.9 trillion bill, which would expand the nation's social safety net and direct billions toward fighting climate change. It blindsided Biden and other Democrats who'd hoped to pass the bill, which cleared the House in November. Early next year. "I cannot vote to continue with this piece of legislation. I just can't," said Manchin. He cited concerns about deficit spending during a time of rising inflation, the pandemic, and geopolitical unrest, and was reportedly angry that Democrats had publicly singled him out as an impediment. His announcement drew a sharp rebuke from White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki, who called it a sudden and inexplicable reversal. Manchin has repeatedly criticized the funding mechanism in the bill, a 10-year plan that funds numerous programs for shorter periods to keep the price tag down. He says the bill should fully fund its provisions by removing some of them, and has in particular taken aim at a one-year extension of the enhanced child tax credit that gives most parents up to $300 a month per child. Several colleagues said he had privately raised concerns that parents would spend that money on drugs. The Washington Post reported that during negotiations, Manchin had proposed a $1.8 trillion bill that would expand Obamacare, fund universal pre-K for 10 years, and include hundreds of billions in climate change spending, but lose the child tax credit, a measure progressives strongly support. Biden and some Democrats expressed optimism that a reworked bill can still pass. Manchin and Biden had a cordial conversation that ended with an understanding that negotiations would continue. "Senator Manchin and I are going to get something done," Biden said. What the editorial said: Manchin has done a service to the country, said the Wall Street Journal. By blocking the Democrats' radical agenda, he's rescued us from huge tax increases and new entitlements that would fan inflation and erode the incentive for Americans to work. Democrats howling over his principled stand should instead thank him for making them face political reality before they leap off a cliff. Manchin's resistance could prove productive, said the Washington Post. His fear that the bill would goose inflation is groundless, but he zeroed in on the bill's root problem, a refusal to make hard choices and prioritize programs for long-term funding. If Democrats can unite around key measures, including climate spending, support for children, and making Obamacare health plans cheaper, they may end up with a substantially better bill. What the columnist said: Manchin's arguments for opposing the bill are a combination of nonsensical and incoherent, said Michael Cohen in MSNBC.com. He trumpets concerns for threats like the national debt while ignoring more pressing threats. The tax credit could reduce child poverty by 40%, and expanded Obamacare subsidies could help address the U.S.'s declining life expectancies. Climate change, meanwhile, puts the planet's long-term future at risk. It doesn't get any more threatening than that. Manchin is right about one thing, said Jonathan Chait in nymag.com. Democrats were acting on the belief that once a public benefit is in place, Congress will be loath to end it. But there's a big difference between proactively killing a program and letting one expire. The latter is very easy to do and will be the inevitable result if Republicans regain control of Congress. Democrats' failure to grasp that reality is an act of catastrophic stupidity. After passing the $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan and a $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure package, Biden and the Democrats could be closing out 2021 on a note of pride and accomplishment, said Charles Cook in the National Journal. Instead, they head into the holiday season deeply demoralized and badly damaged politically, and it's their own fault. They badly miscalculated what was realistic with a 50-50 Senate, forgetting a key political maxim: if you want to do big things, you have to win elections big. A once-in-a-generation opportunity to improve American society is still within Democrats' grasp, said Ben Ritz in the New York Times. Even a scaled-back bill could deliver both lasting policy changes and the political victory they so desperately need. It'll mean making hard choices, like abandoning or scaling back the child tax credit, but the surviving programs will be more successful, more popular, and more durable. Compromise isn't easy, but failure is something America cannot afford. And we'll go ahead and get the second main story, certainly on people's minds. Omicron cases explode across U.S. What happened? The highly contagious Omicron variant was driving a massive wave of COVID infections across the U.S. this week, with health experts warning that the strain could soon bring record-breaking daily case counts, but potentially fewer deaths than last winter's surge. The U.S. is reporting some 150,000 new cases a day, 73% of which are caused by Omicron. By late next month or early February, the country could be recording 400,000 new cases a day, according to a forecast by the University of Washington. Last winter's peak was 250,000. Single-day COVID deaths could climb as high as 2,000. Last week's winter's peak was 3,500. Early data from South Africa and Scotland suggests that hospitalization risk with Omicron is about two-thirds lower than with Delta, but more breakthrough infections are likely. Research indicates two doses of Pfizer's and Moderna's vaccines are only 33% effective at preventing an Omicron infection, although protection against serious illness remains strong. Getting a booster shot lifts protection against symptomatic illness to 75%. Despite the surge, President Biden said the U.S. would not lock down or close schools. "This is not March of 2020, he said. 200 million people are fully vaccinated. We're prepared. With long lines building at testing centers, he said the government will buy 500 million at-home COVID tests and distribute them to Americans for free. Some 1,000 military medical personnel will also be deployed to overburdened hospitals. The Food and Drug Administration this week authorized Pfizer's antiviral pill, Paxlovid, which can be taken at home after COVID symptoms start. In clinical trials, it reduced the risk of severe disease by nearly 90%. What the editorial said. "A sense of foreboding is unsettling the nation," said the Washington Post. "Intensive care units in more than 100 communities are already at full capacity because of the earlier Delta wave. And we're now discovering that Omicron can crash through the wall of immunity two shots were promised to provide. Those with boosters seem to be protective, but so far constitute only 30% of the fully vaccinated. To win the fight against Omicron, Biden must declare total war on the virus, funding vaccination and testing sites, and getting high-quality masks into every home in the country for free." There isn't much the administration can do at this point, said the Wall Street Journal, and Biden knows it. His free at-home test won't be ready for weeks. So even though his $1.9 trillion spending bill in March was supposed to pay for more testing, he'll have to deal with the bad optics of long lines at testing centers. Biden's main priority should be approving and boosting the production of antivirals, because most monoclonal antibody regimens, our best existing COVID treatments, don't hold up well against Omicron. What the columnists said. "It's the question on everybody's mind," said Derek Thompson in TheAtlantic.com. "Is Omicron milder? The early evidence suggests it is. Researchers have found that while the variant multiplies 70 times faster than Delta in airways, it's far less effective at gaining traction in the lower lungs, where an infection can produce life-threatening pneumonia. But its ability to rapidly replicate in the upper respiratory system could bolster its contagiousness, and a virus that's milder but more contagious will create more severe cases overall. Big businesses, sports leagues, and colleges should start requiring booster shots," said Andy Slavitt in the Washington Post. "A third dose of a COVID vaccine seems to increase antibody response 20-fold or more, enough to beat back even the many troubling mutations of Omicron. Unlike the winter of 2020, we now have the arsenal to keep people healthy and out of the hospital. We just need to get this life-saving medicine into enough arms. We could be entering the deadliest phase of the pandemic," said Umair Irfan in Vox.com, "but much remains unknown. The University of Texas recently produced 18 models of how Omicron could play out. In the best case scenario, we'll have 50% fewer deaths than last winter. In the worst, 20% more. Because of regional differences in vaccination rates, both scenarios could play out in parallel. Boosting, social distancing, and replacing cloth masks with high-quality N95s will help make a bad situation better. Whether the direst predictions come true is partly in our hands. Controversy of the week is Biden, his report card for year one. Democrats are reeling this week over the collapse of President Biden's Build Back Better bill, said John Podhoretz in the New York Post. But his latest humiliation has just put a bow on his mostly horrible first year in office. Future historians can debate whether Biden's disastrous pullout from Afghanistan was the biggest debacle, or the immigration policies that sparked a border crisis to dwarf any we've seen. Ordinary Americans might point to the alarming rise in inflation, soaring gas prices in particular, or a spike in violent crime, or Biden's failure to fix the COVID-19 pandemic, a job he promised to make his top priority. Biden's 41% approval rating is the lowest of his presidency, said The Economist in an editorial. But what should really terrify Democrats is the president's sliding popularity with the young. When Biden took office in January, his net approval rating among voters under 30 was a gaudy plus 31%, the highest of any demographic bloc. Today, it's minus 21%. Biden's failure to make headway on voting rights, climate change, and student debt relief has so demoralized the younger, more progressive voters in the Democratic base that it now threatens his presidency. What about the economy, said Matthew Winkler in Bloomberg.com. Despite inflation largely caused by global supply chain issues and booming demand, the economy as a whole improved more in Joe Biden's first 12 months than under any president during the past 50 years. A major reason for that was Biden's $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan, which slashed child poverty in half, boosted wages, and gave us projected growth this year of 5-6%, the highest since 1984. Unemployment fell to 4.2% amid the creation of 6 million new jobs. Corporate profit percentages are the highest since 1950, and the S&P 500 stock measure has soared 37%, the most ever under any first-year president. Biden won big with a bad hand, said David Frum in TheAtlantic.com. He had to govern amid a pandemic with a narrow majority in the House and a 50-50 Senate, yet still managed to bail us out of a recession and pass a bipartisan $1 trillion hard infrastructure bill that will yield benefits for years to come. Biden is getting blamed for things he can't control, said Derek Thompson, also in TheAtlantic.com. When he took office, 1% of Americans had been vaccinated. Now 71% are. Is the pandemic behind us? No, but Biden's hardly responsible for viral mutations he didn't ask for, or for the fact that millions of misinformed Americans chose to stay unvaccinated. Biden, however, is responsible for his greatest failure of this annus horribilis, said Andrew Sullivan in andrewsullivan.substack.com. He somehow interpreted a modest victory in the Electoral College, shocking losses in the House, and a fluke tie in the Senate as a remit for a big government revolution. It wasn't. After Trump's chaotic 4 years, most voters wanted a moderate president who would competently execute a modest agenda. Instead, they spent a year watching Biden mouth the hideous acronyms of woke language while pushing a transformative vision of America as a far-left utopia. Biden's in a deep hole after year one, said William Galston in the Wall Street Journal. But he can still become the competent centrist voters thought they elected. Centrist meaning a president who governs from the center of his country, not the center of his party. Here's our good week, bad week piece. It was a good week for justice delayed after the Scottish government indicated it will issue formal pardons and apologies to 3,837 people, 84% of them women, who were tried as witches between 1563 and 1736. We absolutely excelled at finding women to burn in Scotland, said campaigner Claire Mitchell. It was a good week for spares after Australian naturalists announced a new species of millipede with an unprecedented 1,306 legs. While millipede literally means 1,000 feet in Latin, the previous record for real-world millipedes topped out at 750 feet. It was a good week for listening to Donald Trump after the former president disclosed during a tour appearance that he got a booster shot and, to some booing, urged the audience to do so. Trump said MAGA fans who disdain vaccination are playing right into their hands. But it was a bad week for Major Biden, the president's two-year-old German Shepherd, whom White House officials announced has been shipped out to family friends after a number of biting incidents. Major will be replaced by Commander, a Shepherd puppy. It was a bad week for second chances after the Prairie DuPont Volunteer Fire Department in St. Clair County, Illinois, named Jerame Simmons, a convicted arsonist, as its acting fire chief. 10 of the department's 13 firefighters resigned on the spot in protest. And finally, it was a bad week for decorum, with a Wall Street Journal report that Americans' use of foul language has exploded, partly because Zoom calls from home encouraged less formal conversation. Cursing, as Executive Tracy Brady put it, is the yoga pants and Uggs of language. I don't always hit the Only in America pieces, but this one caught my eye. A Florida man was banned for life by United Airlines for wearing lacy thong underwear as a face mask, but says his protest was inspired by civil rights icon Rosa Parks. Adam Jen, 38, said he was illustrating the absurdity of the federal mask mandate on flights by wearing women's underwear on my face. He said that, like Parks, he's a lone citizen who may change the course of history. Briefing this week is Ringing in the New. When we celebrate the coming of a new year, we're continuing a tradition that goes back millennia. Who began New Year's? Early Egyptian, Babylonian, and Chinese civilizations all had rituals to mark the beginning of a new year. As early as 3000 BC, the ancient Egyptians held the festival of Wepet Renpet, which means opening of the year, not on January 1st, but tied to the annual flooding of the Nile River around mid-July. The holiday celebrated fertility and rebirth, and in addition to solemn religious rituals, it involved dancing, feasting, and prodigious beer drinking. Some 4,000 years ago, the ancient Babylonians held the 12-day feast of Akitu to celebrate the beginning of the agricultural season around the spring equinox. Statues of the gods were paraded through the streets, feasts were held, and either a new king was crowned or the reigning king's rule was symbolically renewed. The earliest Chinese New Year celebrations date back more than 3,000 years. They likewise were tied to the spring planting season and began with the second new moon after the winter solstice. When did New Year's become tied to January 1st? It began with the ancient Romans. When Julius Caesar revamped the lunar calendar in 45 BC, adding leap years to compensate for the inconvenient fact that the Earth's rotation around the sun takes 365.24 days and not an even 365, the resulting Julian calendar established January 1st as the first day of the year. Previously, it had been tied to the vernal equinox in March, a fact reflected by the number-derived names of later months, September meaning the seventh month, October the eighth, and so forth. January's name derived from Janus, who was the god of new beginnings, but also had two faces. So the dawn of the new year was tied to both looking back at the old and ahead to the new. Romans celebrated January 1st by giving offerings to Janus and exchanging gifts of figs and honey. Did January 1st remain New Year's? Not everywhere. Through the Middle Ages, the New Year was celebrated at different times in different places and periods, most often at the spring equinox in March. When Pope Gregory XIII tweaked the Julian calendar in the late 16th century, his Gregorian calendar also set January 1st as the start of the New Year. But the Protestant British and subsequently the American colonies resisted the Catholic invention, sticking with the Julian calendar and observing New Year's Day on March 25th, the Feast of Annunciation. That lasted until 1752, when the Brits and colonists finally gave in and adopted the Gregorian calendar and began marking the New Year on January 1st. How did New Year's resolutions begin? They had their roots in the very earliest New Year's festivals. During Akitu, the Mesopotamians would make vows to the gods to work hard, pay their debts, and return borrowed items. In Caesar's day, on January 1st, Romans would make sacrifices and vow to behave honorably in the coming year. In the Middle Ages, during Christmas week, knights would place their hands on a peacock and renew their vows of chivalry. John Wesley, the founder of Methodism, established in the mid-18th century a New Year's tradition of renewing one's commitment to God, a counterpoint to the more earthly celebrations in which others indulged. There are no hard markers for when religious resolutions gave way to vows to shed pounds, drink less grog, and engage in personal improvement, but a Boston newspaper article from 1813 contained what's considered the first documented use of the phrase New Year's resolution. It referred to the multitudes who will sin all the month of December, then start the new year with reforms they hope will expiate and wipe away all their former faults. When did Times Square become a focal point? The annual ball drop there is quite literally a media creation. The seed was planted in 1904 when the New York Times moved its headquarters from downtown Manhattan to Broadway and 43rd Street in Midtown. Drawn by an ad in the paper, on December 31st, hundreds of thousands of revelers packed the streets by the new Times building. At midnight, explosives were set off atop the building, a funeral pyre for the old, which pierced the very heavens, the paper wrote. The spectacle was repeated the following 3 years until the city nixed the pyrotechnics. In 1908, they gave way to a 700-pound wood and iron ball lit by 100 bulbs, lowered from the building's flagpole, to great shouting horns and cowbells. Save the war years of 1942 and 1943, a version of the ball, now an LED-lit 12-foot sphere covered in Waterford crystal, has dropped every year since. It's an event watched by an estimated billion people on TV and attended by throngs that still mirror the description in the Times that first year, when the crush was so great that progress was well nigh impossible in any direction. Traditions around the world. While revelry is a common global thread, as the old year gives way to the new. Customs vary widely depending on where you happen to be celebrating. In Spain, revelers down a dozen white grapes in quick succession as the clock strikes midnight, one for each month of the year. The Japanese eat soba noodles. Italians and Chileans eat lentils, and Greeks eat cakes with a coin baked inside, which bestows blessings on whoever draws the lucky slice. In Ecuador, people burn effigies to symbolize letting go of the past year's bad events. Russians torch a slip of paper on which they've written their wishes for the new year and sprinkle the ashes into champagne. The Danes jump off chairs to symbolize leaping into the new year. Costa Ricans carry a suitcase around the block to express a wish to travel in the new year, while Brazilians signal their desires in a more surreptitious way, with color-coded underwear. Red means you seek love, yellow means wealth, green requests good health, and white underwear is a plea for peace. We'll read three of the best columns this week from the U.S., starting with Red States Can't Stop Pill Abortions. If Roe falls, state laws banning abortion just became easier to evade, said Jacob Sullum. The Food and Drug Administration last week ruled that women no longer have to receive the abortion-inducing drugs mifepristone and misoprostol from in-person health care providers, but can have them prescribed through a telemedicine visit. These medications have been proven safe and effective, and the FDA approved their use for up to 10 weeks into pregnancy. Nearly 80% of abortions are performed before that time. Drug-induced abortions account for 42% of the total in 2019, and now that share is likely to rise. Republican state legislatures will seek to make do-it-yourself pills illegal, but the war on drugs has failed for more than a century to stop trafficking and sale of banned substances. To get abortion pills, women could drive over the state lines and have a telemedicine visit in their car or a hotel, with pills mailed to a sympathetic clearinghouse in their state. And within red states, a large black market for the pills will arise. A safe and effective DIY option poses an insurmountable challenge to legislators who hope to eliminate most abortions by force of law. The corruption of legislators trading stocks. Nancy Pelosi believes she's entitled to use her political power to benefit her stock portfolio, said Timothy Carney. The House Speaker last week defended stock trading by members of Congress on the grounds that public servants are entitled to participate in a free market economy. But legislators often have inside information that can make their stock purchases more profitable, or holdings that can affect their views on legislation. Pelosi is a case in point. She has stalled multiple bipartisan antitrust efforts that would affect big tech companies, said Apple CEO, and Apple CEO Tim Cook called her personally in June and told her not to move ahead on these bills. Pelosi's conflict of interest is huge. She owns more than $500,000 in Apple stock, while her very wealthy husband holds significant Apple call options. She's far from the only member of Congress to mix policy making with profit making. In early 2020, Senators Richard Burr, Kelly Loeffler, and Dianne Feinstein made large stock transactions just before the market tanked, after learning at a closed Senate hearing just how bad the COVID-19 pandemic would be. That's indefensible. Legislators should not trade in stocks. The people subsidizing, regulating, taxing, exempting, and protecting corporations should not also be investing in them. Trump's fading aura. Is Donald Trump starting to lose his grip on the Republican Party? Asked Matt Lewis. The former president recently demanded that the GOP oust Mitch McConnell as Senate Minority Leader for rejecting his claim that the 2020 election was stolen. He is a disaster and should be replaced as leader ASAP, Trump said. McConnell wasn't cowed. In fact, he trolled Trump last week by saying the January 6th committee's work will reveal all the participants in the attempted coup and that it is something the public needs to know. Not a single Republican senator came forward to side with Trump against McConnell. Now, Trump himself remains popular with the Republican base, but as a force for endorsements, his glow may be fading. His endorsed Senate candidates have dropped out of or are losing in Pennsylvania and Alabama, and many Republicans are now more excited about younger leaders, like Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who mimic Trump's culture war stance but avoid his self-defeating bombast. Trump, 75, has lost his Twitter and Facebook platforms, and after 7 years of largely dominating the news, his act is getting old. He remains a formidable factor within the GOP, but if he does seek the 2024 nomination, he's not unbeatable. And this is a short viewpoint piece. Quote, in a functioning liberal democracy, Trump would be seen right now as a once-in-a-century kind of monster. His despicable assault on our democracy, a turning point for the GOP in coming to its senses. He would be a pariah far beyond what Nixon was in 1974, untouchable, toxic, despised. His grotesque and corrosive lies about the election are disqualifying on their face. But our liberal democracy is extinct after 4 years of Trump. We are in a tribal war now in which our democratic institutions are mere tools for the conduct of hostilities. End quote. That comes from Andrew Sullivan in andrewsullivan@substack.com. The last word, our feature article, titled this week, There for the Last Breath. Around the U.S., a network of volunteers takes on a moral task as old as human history, said author Ken Budd in the Washington Post magazine, keeping vigil with the dying so they do not finish their lives alone. The woman is dying. She's 78, though she looks younger. I don't know her, and I know little about her aside from her name, her career. She worked for the U.S. Postal Service, and her faith. She was an associate pastor at her Baptist church. I stand by her bed in a Springfield, Virginia nursing home, noticing the religious knickknacks on her brown nightstand, the porcelain figurine of Jesus washing a disciple's feet, a wood cross emblazoned with a quote from Proverbs. She is clothed in strength and dignity, and she laughs without fear of the future. I lean toward her closed eyes to introduce myself. 6 days ago, she stopped eating, drinking, and interacting. She may not survive the night, but her breathing seems surprisingly strong. My name is Ken, I tell her. I'm a volunteer, and I'm going to be staying with you for a bit. It's an honor to be here. I've been volunteering for about a month with Capital Caring Health, a hospice and advanced home care organization that works throughout the Washington region. This is my second time working alone as a vigil volunteer, and despite weeks of training, I'm nervous. Should I talk to her? Should I not talk? Should I hold her hand? Some volunteers sing, some pray. A pastor friend recommended some scripture. I'm not religious. But the woman's roommate, who's quite alive, asks a nurse to turn on the TV, and an episode of Martin blares. Should I shout proverbs over the sitcom zingers and the Geico ads? And what if she opens her eyes? What if her last image on earth is a strange man in a mask? So I sit quietly. The dying can feel our presence, I've been told. That's the mission here. To be a compassionate human being. To provide family members, in this case the woman's devoted daughter, with a break from their vigil. To make certain someone is here if she needs something. To ensure that she won't feel alone, and most important, that she won't die alone. I understand the responsibility. 6 years ago, my 74-year-old mother died alone in her home. As the years have passed, I've felt not only guilt, but also a sense of failure. After my father's death in 2005, I would call Mom nightly around 9 o'clock just to check in and chat. But on September 13, 2015, I was out of the country. My brother-in-law unexpectedly texted, "Call me," he wrote. Two worried neighbors had found Mom's body on her living room floor. She likely died of a heart attack the night before. One neighbor, an early riser, had noticed at 4:30 a.m. that the lights were on and the blinds were up, which was telling. Mom was fanatical about closing blinds. When the neighbors entered that morning, the TV was still on. A 911 operator said to check for a pulse. The body was cold. Mom suffered from anxiety and depression. She didn't like living alone, so she surely hated dying alone. I assume she died quickly, but what if she didn't? What if she was in pain? What if she was traumatized, terrified, aching for someone, anyone, as she died? Over the years, I've tried to push those thoughts aside, but then COVID-19 arrived, and dying alone became one of the pandemic's many cruelties. Patients who died of COVID in 2020 were 12 times as likely to die in a medical facility as patients who died of any cause in 2018, a Northwestern University study found. Because of visitation restrictions, many died without companionships, surrounded at best by the masked faces and gloved hands of medical staff. 3 days before my vigil service at the nursing home in Springfield, I visited my parents' grave in Fairfax, Virginia. It was the 6th anniversary of my mom's death. As I stared at her name on the flat headstone, I still wondered if she suffered. And I found myself asking, why is it so important that people not die alone? Concern over lonely deaths didn't originate with COVID. In 1854, while Britain, France, and the Ottoman Empire were at war with Russia, Florence Nightingale worked to ensure that someone stayed with soldiers as they died. Quarantined individuals frequently died alone in the 1918 influenza pandemic and during the AIDS epidemic. When I was an intern, at least half the patients on the floors were young men with AIDS, said Evelyn Granieri, Emerita Professor of Medicine at Columbia University. We would go in there with our hazmat-like suits, and they died alone. If anyone understands the need to accompany people as they die, it's retired nurse Sandra Clark. On a rainy night in 1986, as Clark made her rounds at the Sacred Heart Medical Center in Eugene, Oregon, a dying patient made a request. He was old, frail, alone, and his organs were failing. He had a do not resuscitate order. With a faint and feeble voice, he asked her, "Will you stay with me?" "Yes," she said, as soon as she finished her rounds. For the next 90 minutes, she visited 6 other patients, assessing vital signs, checking charts, assisting with bathroom trips, providing meds. Finally, she returned to the man's room. It was too late. "I was angry because I felt so helpless," she tells me by phone from her home in Oregon. All he wanted was companionship. It triggered the idea for No One Dies Alone, NODA, a program that places volunteers with patients as they die. Clark modestly calls it a fancy phone tree, but the program has saved thousands of patients from a lonely death. 1,000 to 1,500 NOTA programs exist worldwide in hospitals as well as prisons, though the pandemic put many programs on hold. NOTA serves dying patients who may not have family. Some are homeless. Sometimes a person has been ostracized by relatives. Loved ones may live out of town. At large hospitals, patients often arrive from long distances, including other states. People at all stages of life are social creatures. We want companionship, love, and touch. We surround ourselves with loved ones during major life events, and death is the ultimate life event. Michael T. Manning, a NOTA volunteer at Inova Fairfax Hospital, once sat vigil with a dying man in his late 70s. The man wanted something and tried to speak, but the words wouldn't come. He kept raising his right arm, Manning says. He raised his right arm again, and I took his hand, and he squeezed it. He turned his head to me, and he just smiled. And he embraced my hand even firmer. No words were spoken, but there obviously was a connection. And he began to relax. And I said, okay, you know, we can just sit here and we can hold hands. And I'll just be here. The man fell asleep but didn't die, so Manning left a note for the next volunteer. He likes to have his hand held. Clark recalls a gentleman who woke from a coma-like state and wanted everyone to sing. Boy, this is the most fun I've had in a long time, he declared before dying a few hours later. For many, their social experiences in life influence their needs as death approaches. We found that a lot of homeless people who were dying alone did not want to be touched, Clark says, but they also didn't want you to leave the room. Everyone is different. In some cases, patients hold on, barely alive, until family arrives from out of town, said Claudia Escobedo, manager of community and volunteer engagement for Capital Caring Health in D.C. Once these encounters occur, patients sometimes die minutes or even seconds later, Escobedo has found. And yet I repeatedly hear about family members who sit for hours with a loved one, take a five-minute bathroom break, and discover the person has died during their brief absence. We used to find this in ICU. Sometimes patients wouldn't die until everybody was gone, Clark says. The family would be there for days and days and days, and then everybody left, and suddenly they passed, as though they wanted not to have their family there. At a home in Dale City, Virginia, a dying ex-Marine moans from his bed, the sound bellowing above an oxygen machine's rumble at the wail of Little Richard's Tutti Frutti. Hearing remains our most powerful final sense, I've been told, and music often accompanies vigils. A tube hangs from the 89-year-old man's nostrils. His mouth gapes open, and his eyes are closed. A gurgle interrupts his labored breathing. Congestion is another sign of impending death. The man's son, his primary caregiver, puts drops in his mouth, then dips a cold compress in water, placing it on his forehead. The father's protective poodle leans against his bare chest. When the son adjusts his father's pillow, the dog growls. Mar Flume, a longtime Capital Caring volunteer and retired Marine, sits next to the bed. He asks if he can read scripture. The son approves. And Flume reads Psalm 91 from his phone, then Psalm 23. The son wipes his eyes. Psalm 23 always makes me cry, he says. I stay quiet, feeling like an intruder as the two men chat, and I scan the Olin Mills-style photos, the children's long-ago school pictures, the black-and-white wedding shots on the bedroom walls. Flume has visited once a week for several weeks. The son says that his father has been like this for a few days. He has stopped eating and drinking. He's nonverbal. The old Marine will keep fighting, keep struggling, keep living for three more days before finally, mercifully, succumbing to death. A few days later, I share the scene with Cindy Crane, a 7-year volunteer with Capital Caring. We sit at a shady table outside of a facility near Fort Belvoir, where we visited a resident in assisted living. She shares this reason for why no one should die alone. Dying is hard work. Granieri, the professor who began her career during the AIDS epidemic, was pained by patient suffering in the spring of 2020 at New York Presbyterian Columbia University Irving Medical Center, where she worked as a geriatrician. The hospital was almost entirely filled with COVID patients. Delirious, dying old men with dementia would call out the names of their wives. 70% of patients died, she said. Most died alone, though staff sat with patients when they could. Among our group, we would say, so-and-so is going to die today or maybe tomorrow, and I was present with a few dozen people, either at the moment of death or just before. She recalls, there was a lack of PPE, and we still had less than adequate knowledge about transmission. So you were limited in how much time you could spend in someone's room. The nurses were especially crunched, so the vast majority of people died without anybody at their bedside. The lonely deaths, Granieri says, were heart-wrenching. Her voice cracks as she says it. She stops for a moment. I'm sorry, she tells me. I still cry. I cry about it because it just wasn't right. Clark, the NOTA creator, says many volunteers are motivated by similar regrets. A parent or partner died alone, and it feels wrong. They say, I know I should have been there, so this is my way of doing that, Clark says. But I don't want volunteers to feel guilty over something they didn't control. I can't control the past, but I can assist the dying now, even if it's as simple as holding someone's hand. At a facility near Oakton, Virginia, I sit vigil with a 93-year-old man. The bed is tilted at a 45-degree angle, and though the room feels warm, he's covered by thick blankets. His skin is pale, his mouth open. I introduce myself, and he glances at me, only for a moment before returning to sleep. He knows he is not alone. A version of this story originally appeared in the Washington Post magazine. We'll try to squeeze in one Talking Points article. Fox, a culture of lying exposed. Fox News has been lying to viewers every day since January 6th at SE Cup and the New York Daily News. The right-wing cable network's marquee hosts have spent the past year dismissing the severity of the attempted coup, blaming the FBI and Antifa, and grotesquely handing out the best performance acting awards to assaulted police officers. But the Fox host frantic text messages sent to former President Trump's chief of staff, Mark Meadows, which the House January 6th panel released last week, leave no doubt these frauds were horrified by the insurrection. The president needs to tell people the Capitol go home, Laura Ingraham texted. This is hurting all of us. He is destroying his legacy, Sean Hannity urged that Trump ask people to leave the Capitol. And morning host Brian Kilmeade pleaded, please get him on TV, destroying everything you have accomplished. Hannity apparently believes that he has the dumbest audience in America, said Kevin Williamson in NationalReview.com. He and his colleagues are now arguing that the Capitol attack was no different than the looting, arson, and rioting in Seattle, Portland, Oregon, and other cities in recent years. Well, a riot that is part of a coup d'etat is not very much like a riot that is part of a coup de target. And didn't CNN fire Chris Cuomo recently for doing precisely what Hannity, Ingraham, and Kilmeade did, give secret advice to help a politician? The difference, said Jonah Goldberg in thedispatch.com, is that most Fox hosts are utterly shameless in their lying, which is why I quit the network this year. Not incidentally, I often heard these propagandists say one thing about Trump and other topics in my presence, and another thing when the cameras and microphones were flipped on. Fox isn't the most watched cable news network in spite of the lying, but because of it, said Adam Serwer in TheAtlantic.com. From downplaying the headlines of COVID to spreading doubts about the vaccines to promote the big lie that helped motivate the riot in the first place, Fox tells viewers what they want to hear, not what they ought to know. As a result, conservative viewers are fiercely loyal to Fox, and despite the so-called mainstream media, the network's success depends on maintaining a fantasy world rather than doing anything to disturb it. And a short note here, an estimated 163,000 COVID deaths in the U.S. over the past year could have been prevented by vaccination, according to an analysis by the Kaiser Family Foundation. Some 28% of U.S. adults remain unvaccinated, and some health officials expect that the death toll will rise in coming months from 805,000 to more than 1 million. And we'll finish the show with a quote from writer Margaret Halsey, who says, "Democracy produces both heroes and villains, but it differs from a fascist state in that it does not produce a hero who is a villain." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten by the law firm of W.G. Alexander & Associates. Alexander attorneys provide top-rated and experienced legal counsel concentrating on estate planning, elder law, special needs, and asset protection. Call W.G. Alexander & Associates at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.